Starwalker Studios presents The Obsidian Monolith, creating an original campaign for Numenera.
Greetings, Numenarian, and welcome to the sixth episode of The Obsidian Monolith. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Today, I'll describe some of the NPCs in Bonespur, and I'll share the creation of the first adventure in the campaign, The Windmill in the Woods. So grab a pen, grab some paper, and get your creative juices going. It's time to create an adventure. I am continuing today talking about the town Bonespur I came up with. I'm just going to share a few of the NPCs with you, and then we're going to get into the first adventure, The Windmill in the Woods. The first NPC I want to talk about is Father Moshe On, and Father On is the Eon Priest in Bonespur. It's assumed when the PCs start out that they've already gotten to know him, that they've been in the town for some time. And again, he is the only Eon Priest in the town. He's a grizzled man of indeterminate age. He could be anywhere between 50 to 70 years old. It's hard to tell. He's partially bald, and the hair he has is thinning and gray. He is unshaven with short gray stubble. He's of average height and build and has gray eyes. He commonly wears a belted robe of umber and brown. He has a black metallic device embedded into the back of his neck that gives him far-seeing abilities. When he uses these abilities, his eyes turn white. He has a rock-solid personality. He's slow to anger and not one to joke around. He takes his work and that of the Order very seriously. He has a very idealistic view of right and wrong, and his public disapproval of some of the Order's more political moves, like the recent crusades against the Gaians, has prevented him from rising as high in the ranks of the Order as he probably should have. He spent a great deal of time studying the Kalovas since he's been in Bonespur, and he's been in the town for a few years at this point. After much effort and time, he was able to learn their language, and he can teach it to any PC who wants to learn it. And basically, if the PCs want to learn Kalova, they can do so by spending 2 XP, and boom, they know Kalova, and it's just part of their backstory that while they've been in town, they've been studying the language with Father On. About a year ago, he met with the leader of the nearest Kalova tribe in the Westwood, and he made an agreement with her. In exchange for the Kalovas not attacking the loggers of Bonespur, the people of Bonespur agreed to only log in the specific areas of the Westwood that the Kalovas designated. This peace has been maintained for a little over a year, and both sides seem happy with it, although relations between the two peoples has not progressed beyond the initial agreement. And again, as I've said in previous episodes, I've set this up in such a way that the PCs can step into this situation and either improve it or make it worse. It's up to them. Another NPC I came up with that I'll share with you is the mayor of the town. Her name is Annika Oviel, and most people actually just call her by her first name. And she's a middle-aged woman with blonde hair and blue eyes. She usually wears her hair up in a style that is elegant and practical. Of average height, she is an imposing presence due to the intelligence in her eyes and the steadiness of her gaze. She is an excellent judge of character and does not allow herself to hold preconceptions of a person based on rumor or appearances. Her ability to see into the heart of someone and see potential they may not know themselves that they have is legendary in the town. She is selfless with her time and her energy, spending practically every waking moment in service to the town. She came to Bonespur some 10 or so years ago. Rumor has it that her husband was killed soon before that, but no one knows for sure or even where the rumor came from, because she won't talk about it. Though she's had countless suitors, she is far too busy to spend time on romance. She's intelligent and fair-minded, and if it were up to her, she'd pursue closer relations, even an alliance, with the Kalovas. But the people of the town are an insular, superstitious lot, and she knows it. It wasn't that long ago they all believed the Kalovas were spirits or tree folk. I have some minor characters I've come up with, as well as some of the major characters. And some of the major characters I'm going to save for later because they tie into one of the later adventures. There's Nara Devin. She's the teacher in Bonespur. She teaches the children. She's a big fan of Father On. And if the GM wishes, there could even be a conflict, or that a conflict could develop between her and Madam Sadle, who is also a big fan of Father On. There's Aldous Drudd, and he is the quote-unquote doctor of the town. He has some Numenera devices that help him take care of the sick and injured, and he is always on the lookout for more. So if the PCs uncover any ciphers or even artifacts that they don't want, and if they're of a medical or could be used for medical uses, he might take them off their hands, although those are probably ciphers that the PCs would want to keep. There is a gentleman by the name of Kerdrick. He is the stable master for the Loggers Rest. The Loggers Rest stable also serves as a stable for anyone else in the town who needs one. He also breeds and sells Galen, which are a herd animal that's very common in the Ninth World. And unfortunately, to my knowledge, there is no picture of one anywhere in any of the Numenera supplements, which is quite an oversight considering how common they are. But what are you going to do? I think they're described as vaguely antelope-like. So you've got that much to go on, I guess. Elred Smith is Bonespur's blacksmith. He is a big burly guy with a black beard and black hair. His arms are covered in wiry hair and burn scars, and he's generally regarded by the others in the town as being fearless. Brel Utan owns and operates the general store. One of the loggers is named Merid, and he is a person who especially hates the Kalovas. Secretly, it's because he's scared of them, of course. And he does not trust the PCs or their motives and will make trouble for them every time he can. So he's someone that you can use to create some conflict in the town, because if things go well fairly quickly in the campaign, the PCs kind of become heroes of this small town. So it is good to have some people that don't think that they're awesome and create troubles for them. So that's some of the NPCs I come up with, and I'm always coming up with more. You can never have too many NPCs, even in a small town like this. So that's Bonespur. That's the base of operations for the PCs in the beginning of the campaign. So we've got our setting kind of nailed down at this point. So now we've got to get the story started. And I've talked a bit before about what I'm looking for in a first adventure. I want it to be fairly straightforward. I want it to be fun. I want it to be kind of more action oriented than maybe a lot of the stuff I do. Just for players that are maybe coming from more mainstream games like D&D, to kind of ease them into the cipher system. But I also want to show the setting and the weirdness that is Numenera, and I want to give them a really cool discovery to explore. And I want to, through this discovery, kind of show how what would be a quote-unquote dungeon crawl in a game like D&D is a bit different in this game. So I need a discovery for the PCs to explore in the Westwood. I want it to be in the Westwood because I think it's a cool place. And I also would like, with this adventure, to introduce them to the Kalovas and let them start to develop their own opinion of what they think of this species. And also, I want to give them opportunities to explore and learn the system. So if I can find opportunities to use some different mechanics or different kinds of roles, then I want to do that. So as I started trying to think of a discovery for the PCs to explore. As I was doing this, I was in the process of moving from Washington to Indiana, and on my drive, I believe it was in Wyoming, I saw a lot of windmills. And I found myself thinking of the windmills, and I thought, well, that would be kind of a fun thing to base my discovery on, because depending where the players are from, you know, windmills could be a fairly familiar thing to them, or at the very least, they probably have an impression of windmills as they're pretty simple, pretty old technology. There's nothing weird or exciting about a windmill, right? So I thought it would be a fun thing to take as a basis for my discovery and make a windmill Numenera style. So the adventure begins in the spring and starts out by Father An summoning the PCs to meet with him, and he tells them that he has a very important mission for them. And as I think I mentioned in earlier episodes, the campaign is going to start out a little more linear, a little more kind of giving the PCs a very clear path to follow. Again, in case there are players who are new to role-playing games, to make it easy. If you just throw a brand new group into a pure sandbox, a lot of times they just kind of sit and stare at you and wait for you to give them something to do. So I don't want that to happen at the beginning of this campaign. I want there to be a clear direction in the beginning. And then as the campaign goes, it opens up more and more the PCs can kind of decide where they want to go from there and how they want to deal with things. As part of the character creation, I have asked my players to create characters who are either new initiates into the Order of Truth and are eager to prove themselves to the Order and get more standing and reputation and rank within the Order, or have them make a character who is not a member of the Order of Truth, but very much wants to be. So at this point, all of the player characters should have as a motivation of their character to make a good impression on the Order. And Father An basically gives them a chance to do exactly that. He has something that he wants them to take care of, and he promises them that if they do a good job, he will speak with his contacts within the Order that he's still on good terms with and recommend the PCs either for promotion or for admittance into the Order, depending on where they're at. Basically, what's going on is Father An has noticed a couple weeks ago that the plants in and around the town of Bonespur, the flowers, the vegetables, the fruits, etc., that they aren't budding like they should be. And this was odd and worrisome. So he investigated the situation and he discovered that the plants weren't being pollinated. Although the pollinating species, which are mainly various types of bees and what he calls hummers, which are basically hummingbirds, are still around and still active, they don't seem to be interacting with the plants in the way that they normally do, which leads to pollinization. So this is a potential disaster, because if these plants aren't pollinated soon, then there will be no vegetables in the gardens, there will be no crops in the fields, and it could result in a famine, not only for this town, but this whole area. So, of course, at this point, Moshe became quite alarmed, and he used the clairvoyant ability of his implant to try and find the source of this problem. At the same time, he began speaking with the farmers, herders, and loggers in the town just to see if they'd noticed anything unusual or different lately, to see if he could try to figure out what's going on. So at this point, when he asked the PCs to come speak with him, he believes that he's found a lead that has a good chance of being connected to this whole issue. He tells the PCs that about 4 hours travel from the edge of the Westwood into the Westwood, there is a large structure that was built by the ancients that the people of the area call the windmill, mainly because it looks vaguely like a windmill. Now, this structure, if the PCs have been in the town for very long, they've probably already heard of it. It's a kind of a common landmark. The villagers are all familiar with it, although most of them have never gone anywhere near it because they're afraid of it. The structure has always emitted a strange buzzing sound that could be heard up to half a mile away and actually felt up to a mile away. So if you have ever been near a high tension line, imagine a sound like that, only more powerful and deeper in pitch. The loggers, who where they log is not super far from there, and sometimes they venture exploring a little bit out from there, as well as some trappers and hunters that have gone near this structure report that in recent weeks, the sound that this structure emits has gotten louder. And they also say that the animals in the area and even the insects have started acting strangely. Namely, they are becoming much more aggressive than normal and have even attacked people. So animals that normally aren't aggressive at all have become aggressive, and animals that were normally predators but didn't come near people will now come after people. So when Father An heard about this, he formed a hypothesis that the strange behaviors of the creatures around the windmill and the problem with the pollinators in and near the town might be connected. And if so, he suspects that this windmill may somehow be at the root of the problem. So he asked the PCs to go and explore the windmill and figure out what's going on, try to figure out if there's something up with the windmill and if it is connected to this, if it is, if they can do anything to rectify the situation. Now, he has no idea what the windmill does. He's never explored it himself, and he's more than a little curious about it. So he also would like any information that they can give him just about what it's like, what it may do, what its function may be. Now, if the PCs ask him for more information, he says that he hopes that they can find a way to, quote unquote, return it to normal. Because, you know, as a Neum priest, he loves studying this kind of stuff. And any time a discovery like this is damaged or lost is a bad thing in his mind. If they can't find a way to, quote unquote, fix it, they may have to destroy it. But he warns them that if it comes to that, to be very careful, because destroying things left by the ancients, if it's even possible, can oftentimes be extremely dangerous for you and everything around you. Of course, I came up with the windmill itself, and I came up with some background information for myself just to help me describe it and what it's doing in a way that makes sense, even though most of this information will never be revealed to the PCs. They won't really have a way to figure a lot of it out. But this is kind of what I came up with for this discovery. So the windmill, of course, isn't a windmill at all. It's a structure that was built by one of the previous eight worlds millions of years ago. I wrote out a description, and I wrote this quite a while ago, so I don't know how good it is. I'm sure it's first draft of the description, so I'm sure it could be improved. Here's the description I wrote in the actual adventure itself that I'm writing. I'm being very careful for every scene to write a description that the GM can read to the players, because I really like adventures that do this, and some of the adventures by Monty Cook Games, I think The Devil's Spine is one, they don't do this, and they just write a description mainly for the GM, so the GM either has to write out her own description to read to the players, or has to memorize all this stuff and then give her own description extemporaneously, or try to kind of read through the description and paraphrase it. And I've done this, and I've heard other GMs on actual plays do this. A lot of times you end up giving the players information that they shouldn't have as you're doing this, because it's not spelled out in the description. Like, this is the bit you read to the players. So I find that really bothersome. You know, part of the reason of running a published adventure is that have less work to do. And when you have to go through every description and rewrite it so you can read it to the players, it's not really saving you much work at all. So I wanted to, in my adventure, I wanted to be sure to write descriptions that the GM can give to the players or paraphrase that isn't going to have information that shouldn't be given to the players. The land around you is heavily wooded with deciduous trees of various species. Other than the narrow path you're following, the ground is choked with underbrush. The path leads you up a steep slope. You can see the top of the windmill ahead through the trees. You climb to the top of the rise and the path ends there. You look out below you and can finally see the windmill in its entirety. The ground slopes down, choked with underbrush, ultimately leading to a large bowl set into the earth. The bowl is constructed of some seamless golden metal that is highly reflective. The light of the sun gleams off of it, dazzling your eyes. As you shade your eyes from the reflected sunlight, you see that the windmill rises from the center of the bowl. The windmill does look slightly like its namesake. It is constructed of a shiny silvery metal. It stands approximately 1,500 feet tall. The bottom half of the structure is large and solid, roughly pyramidal in shape. The top half of the structure is a thin spire, seeming too thin to hold itself up. Attached to the spire are two sets of blades. Each set of blades has four blades. One set is attached at the base of the spire, halfway up the windmill. The other set of blades is at the very top of the spire. Unlike a true windmill, however, which has blades in a vertical plane perpendicular to the ground, these blades are in a horizontal plane parallel to the ground. The blades are long and thin and appear to be made of the same silvery metal as the rest of the structure. The top set of blades are spinning clockwise, while the bottom set of blades are spinning counterclockwise. You don't know what's making the blade spin, but it's not the wind, as there is no wind at all. The vibrating hum you've been hearing for some time now is obviously coming from the windmill. At this distance, you can feel the hairs on your body and head slowly lifting up with static charge. So that's a bit of a description of the windmill. And what this actually is, what the GM will know that this is some kind of device that uses neutrinos or some other high energy particle to generate energy. This energy is then beamed to a satellite or perhaps a network of satellites, or it could be something else in high orbit of Earth. Excess energy is collected and stored in huge batteries hundreds of feet below the ground level, and this is well beyond the reach of the scan esoteric. Somehow, the wireless connection between the windmill and the satellites in orbit has been recently severed. The batteries deep underground have been charged beyond their capacity. They are now emitting harmful radiation and electromagnetic fields that are the source of the strange happenings in the area. In order to solve this problem, the connection between the windmill and the satellite or satellites must be reestablished. Another possibility would be destroying the windmill, but that would be exceedingly difficult and dangerous to do. Also, if this method is used, it will take some time for the excess energy to bleed from the batteries, probably a matter of months. This will not solve the problem soon enough for this year's crops and other plants to be pollinated. Widespread famine would be only one of a multitude of unpleasant consequences. If, however, the connection is reestablished, the excess energy is beamed to the satellites in space, rectifying the situation in a matter of hours. So that's basically the deal. So in a nutshell, the PCs will need to figure out how this thing works, figure out that there is some kind of broken connection between it and these devices high, high above, and figure out a way to reestablish that connection. And if you notice, I've set up an alternative, quote unquote, solution here where they could just destroy the facility. You know, that's for the murder hobos out there. And if you notice farther on, if the PCs actually spend time and talk with him and maybe make some social roles, will reveal that that's a possibility, but cautions them that it could be very dangerous. And basically, if the PCs go that route, they would probably go that route because they would think this is going to be quicker and easier than exploring all this and figuring all this out. We can just destroy it. But as far as the roles involved, it's actually a lot harder than exploring it because the structure itself, the materials, most of them are level 10. So for tier 1 characters, it's going to be almost impossible, if not impossible, for them to destroy it unless they're super creative. And then even if they do, it actually doesn't solve the problem because it takes so long for this energy to go away that by the time it does, it's already too late for this year. And now the PCs must deal with the consequences of their actions, which I don't know. I think could be a good lesson for people that play like that. If the GM can swing it, I don't know. My playtest group did not even consider that as a possibility, which was nice and definitely made things easier for them. So the bottom half of the structure is the part that can be explored. It's basically a facility that has an interior to it. The top half, as I described, is just this thin metal spire that obviously you couldn't fit within unless something really weird is going on. The structure is entered by an entranceway that is 20 feet tall and 20 feet wide, which is more than enough, you know, space for the PCs to get in. There doesn't seem to be a door of any kind keeping them from entering. It's just an open entrance. However, to get to the windmill, the PCs first must get across this metal bowl. And I was careful not to describe it to the players this way because I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to keep the mythos of the setting. But basically, if you picture like a satellite dish, that's what this bowl looks like. It's a huge satellite dish set into the ground. And the windmill is at the center of the dish, and the dish is made of this super reflective golden metal. And basically the idea is these particles, these neutrinos or whatever they are coming in from space. They're hitting this dish and then reflecting back up, and that's what's moving the windmill blades and what's creating power. Whether or not that would actually work or what type of particles these are doesn't matter. Because it's way beyond the comprehension of the PCs and even the GM anyway. And again, this is Numenera. We don't want to explain stuff too much. But it is a good idea to have some kind of idea of in broad strokes what's going on, just to help you describe things and decide what happens when PCs do various things. So that's my discovery. That's my setup. I also, of course, want to have some quote-unquote encounters or some obstacles for the PCs to overcome. And one thing I want to do is I want to give them an encounter before they even enter the windmill, because I've set up that this radiation or the EM field or whatever it is doing strange things to the animals and making them more violent. I've already foreshadowed that, you know, they've attacked people. So I want to really bring this home by having the PCs attacked by some creature that's been driven crazy by what the structure is putting out. And it makes sense that, you know, the creatures closest to it would be the most affected. One of the beginning things I do when creating an adventure in any system is I look through the monster guide of that system and look for any interesting critters that I might want to put in. And so I did this for this adventure, and I was looking for creatures that I thought would work well for creatures of the Westwood that have been driven crazy by the windmill and attacked the PCs, as well as creatures that might have taken up residence within the windmill, or creatures, automatons, basically, that could be perhaps part of the windmill's security systems, if it has any, and also trying to come up with encounters that aren't creatures, but are obstacles presented by the windmill itself. Perhaps areas that are damaged, that are hard to get through, or security systems that the windmill has, as well as its systems as far as how will the systems work, how will the PCs interface with them, and how will they be able to figure out what's going on and how to fix it. For my encounter outside the windmill, I finally settled on slicer beetles, which are found in the bestiary for the Ninth World. And these are actually pretty formidable foes. And also what I wanted to do with this first encounter, when I came up with the slicer beetles, I thought it made sense that the slicer beetles and the Colovas would not get along, or at least I've decided they don't get along. The slicer beetles seem very insect-like, and the Colovas are very spider-like or arachnid-like. And in our world, a lot of times spiders eat insects and prey upon them. So I thought I would play upon this and say that the Colovas and the slicer beetles are enemies. And also, the slicer beetles are not intelligent. They're, you know, animal level intelligence. And they're kind of similar to the Colovas. Not super similar, but sort of similar. More similar than the Colovas are to humans, say. And if you look at humans, we are often most violent towards animals that are the most similar to us. You look at how we treat the primates and the fact that we've driven the other hominid species like the Neanderthals to extinction. We don't like competition. We don't like things that too closely remind us of ourselves or too similar to ourselves. And we tend to kill them and hunt them down and drive them to extinction if we can. And I think that this is probably just a function of evolution and a survival strategy. And so I think it makes sense that the Colovas would have similar feelings about the slicer beetles, these kind of primitive sort of analogs to themselves. So I figured that even though if you look at the entries in, you know, the books, if you compare a Colova entry, the Colova entry with a slicer beetle, there's no way that a Colova could take on a slicer beetle. Slicer beetles are way more powerful. However, Colovas are intelligent and they work in a group and they use group strategies like ambush and traps and stuff like that. So I think that in the past, the Colovas were always had the edge because they were smarter and they were social and all that stuff. But now these slicer beetles that live near the windmill, not only has the windmill made them more aggressive, but it's actually mutated them and made them more powerful and more dangerous. And so now they're a real threat to the Colovas. So I wanted to have an encounter at the very beginning before they enter the windmill that allows them to see the Colovas hopefully as allies, or at the very least not immediately as antagonists. And also, I thought it would be fun if the PCs can actually interact with the Colovas to kind of give the Colovas' view of the windmill, to see the windmill from another point of view. So what I came up with is that when the PCs reach this point, they're standing at the top of this hill looking down at this metal bowl and the windmill coming out of the middle of it, that they get attacked by some, as I call them, enraged slicer beetles. Now, one thing, and this was probably the first major revision I made to the adventure, this was way, way too hard of a challenge. And you can listen to the actual play and hear what happened there. It's actually pretty humorous. But basically what I wanted to happen was I wanted to present a challenge that at first, like when the players are rolling initiative, they think, all right, this will be a fun encounter, right? And then they engage the enemy. And then maybe for the first round or two, they think we're going to win or we have a good chance of winning. And then they realize that they're horribly outmatched or outnumbered or outgunned and start thinking, we should not have gotten ourselves in this situation. We need to get out of it. And then at that moment, have some Colovas come on the scene and help the PCs fight off the slicer beetles. And I was very much imagining the Colovas coming on the scene, very much like when the Ewoks help the rebels fight the stormtroopers in Return of the Jedi. You know, they're using these very primitive traps and snares and deadfalls and stuff like that against these Colovas. And, you know, they have greater numbers while the PCs are, you know, more powerful individually. But in my efforts to create an encounter that was, you know, challenging to the point that the PCs couldn't easily defeat it, I actually made it too challenging. And if you remember back quite a few episodes in GM Intrusions, I talked a bit about how you can't go by the guidelines given in the Numenera core book as far as what level of a creature is a challenge for a party of characters. And this was one of the reasons for that, because by the book, the encounter I came up with should have been a serious challenge, I believe is how the book put it. And it was way more powerful than that. So again, you can't go by what the book says. Those guidelines are way oversimplified, because it really depends what kind of abilities these creatures have. Basically, what I'd originally done is I took an adult slicer beetle, which there's three different types of slicer beetles given, and then I advanced them using the creature advancement rules, and they just ended up being way too powerful. For one thing, when they hit you, they have a pretty good chance of destroying your armor. And for another thing, they had a high enough armor rating that the PCs were doing very little damage, and really only the glaive, I think, was able to even do much damage at all. So yeah, listen to the first, or actually it's the second part of the first session of the actual play. It's pretty hilarious. They got through it, but it went a little differently than I intended. So I've had to rewrite that encounter and tone the slicer beetles back a bit. I also had fewer of them. Another thing that I'm doing in this adventure is I try to come up with at least two GM intrusions for every encounter. So as a GM, for each encounter you have, if it's a creature, you have the GM intrusion given in the creature entry, and you also have at least two GM intrusions that I'm giving you to use for ideas for your own GM intrusions. That's the first encounter, and so basically the PCs are attacked by these enraged slicer beetles. They're overmatched, and the Kalovas show up to help them out and help drive off the slicer beetles. And I took a page from John Wright's book. He did a great YouTube video about how he creates adventures, and he has a step in his process that he calls adding the spice, which is brilliant and is something I now try to do with pretty much all my encounters, which is to add some kind of other element that makes things interesting. So what I did with this encounter is I added the element of this shiny metal bowl itself. I waited until the PCs were starting to cross it before the beetle showed up. And so I added some mechanics, because this metal is so slippery and smooth. It added some movement issues. So basically the system I came up with for this is that the PCs could move an immediate distance without much trouble, because they're like carefully moving along this. But if they tried to move any more than an immediate distance, they had to make a roll. And basically if they fail the roll, they slip and fall. And so that added into the tenseness of the encounter, because not only did they have to deal with the slicer beetles, but they also had to be careful with their movement and make some rolls not to fall prone, which is very bad in a combat encounter where you're outmatched. Again, the Kalovas come and help the PCs out, and then they have a chance after the battle to interact with some of the Kalovas if they want. And something that I did, and it actually worked pretty well, I was a little worried about if this would work, was I, at that moment when the battle's over and a couple of the Kalovas come up to the PCs to parlay with them, I told the players, if you want, you can spend 2 XP at this point for a short-term ability, which is knowing the Kalova language, and you can say that prior to this, you had studied the language with Father On, and he had taught it to you, or at least the basics of it to you. I also made sure during the battle that every PC had 2 XP. I gave them each a GM intrusion during the battle, and I believe I actually started the PCs with 1 XP in this adventure. I made sure that at this point, they all at least had the potential to have 2 XP. So if one of them wanted to, that they could spend that XP to learn the language and be able to actually talk to these guys. And I was a little concerned, because it's like I'm breaking the action a tiny bit to give them this option, and it might seem a little contrived that, oh, this person shows up and I'm going to let you spend XP to retroactively say that you know their language so you can talk to them. but it seemed to work fine. And I asked the players about it later, and they actually thought it was kind of cool. I think that if I would have at the beginning of the adventure said, oh, you can get the Clova language if you want, A, it would have kind of tipped my hand that it would become important later. And I wanted that to be a little bit more of a surprise. And B, I don't know that they would have done it. But if you do it this way and you wait until it becomes relevant and then you give them the option, it's more likely that one of them will actually do it. And one of the players did, and his character knew Kolovan. And so he, even now, is the translator for the PCs and the Kolovas. So I came up with some Kolova NPCs for them to interact with and kind of have a cordial conversation with. And they find out that the Kolovas call the windmill the Tower, and that they, while not superstitiously afraid of it like the humans, that they tend to stay away from it because the fields that it emits, even when it's normal, tends to give them headaches. And now it basically gives them migraines because its output has increased. So they find that out, and then they enter the windmill itself. And also the Kolovas are very eager for the PCs to figure out and solve this problem, because the area of the Westwood that they avoid because of the windmill has increased quite a bit in size, because it's putting out this sound or this vibration even more than it was before. The interior of the windmill is a single central vertical shaft lined with conduits and pipes, with small branching chambers and halls extending from it. There are stairways going from level to level at various places. The central shaft is relatively open, allowing someone to look up the entire 750-foot height of the lower part of the structure. For the most part, the interior is unlit, and the PCs will need to find their own light sources. The first level is partially lit from the open entranceway, and occasionally there is a little ambient light from still operational control panels. In a few areas, there are emergency lights in the form of kind of like red track lighting along the walls at the floor and ceiling level that flicker feebly. But in many places, the lights are no longer functioning, although they could be possibly brought online by crafty PCs, as could the main lighting arrays. Most of the chambers in the structure have ceilings at least 20 feet high. The doorways are also this large, suggesting that the builders of this facility may have been quite large indeed. However, the control panels and interfaces are at a height that makes them comfortable for human use. There are no chairs or furniture in the facility. There are also no doors in the structure, only doorways. And something that the players learn at the end of the adventure is that the doorways do normally have quote-unquote doors, but that these doors can consist of an impassable energy field, but this is turned off right now or not functioning. Once the players enter the structure, it is stifling and hot inside. I did a lot to describe at the beginning of this adventure how hot and humid this area is at this time of year. And each PC takes one mite damage each hour that they spend in the structure. And this is just representing the toll that this heat takes on them. So if you've ever, on a hot day when it's like 90 plus degrees out, and you go into your car that's been sitting in the sun all day, that's kind of what the PCs are dealing with. This problem can be solved by reactivating the windmill's ventilation and climate control system. And my players in the playtest actually did this and came up with this all by themselves, which is pretty awesome. So they didn't have to deal with the one mite damage every hour. Also, within an hour of entering the structure, the dangerous radiation and electromagnetic fields results in each character gaining a random cosmetic mutation. And this mutation will fade about an hour after they leave the windmill, but it remains the whole time that they're in the windmill. The entire structure is constructed of exotic metals, ceramics, and synth. In some areas, dangerous electricity arcs across the rooms and corridors, seemingly at random. This can happen anytime as a GM intrusion, as well as when rolled for on one of the tables, and I'll get into that in a second. And so I have systems for all this stuff that I came up with, and this is really easy to do. There is a table in the core book that has various types of ambient damage, whether it's from electricity or fire and stuff like that. And you can kind of use that as a guide for coming up with stuff like that. The control panels and interfaces of the windmill are touch screens made of reflective metal or clear synth or glass or something like it. When a PC's fingers gets close to the surface, electricity arcs to his fingertips from the screen, making the connection. A repelling magnetic-like force keeps the PC from actually being able to touch the screen. Instead of letters, numbers, or pictures, the interfaces show complex three-dimensional fractal shapes that the PCs have never seen before. After a time using the interfaces, the PC can start to understand the shapes. Again, I have systems I've come up with this with intellect rolls and things like that, where the PCs can start to learn the interfaces and do different things with them. The fractal language can be learned as a short-term benefit for 2XP. Although for verisimilitude, I wouldn't let them do this right away, but after they've explored for a bit, they can do that. However, the PC will only be able to read it. She won't be able to speak it or understand it if she hears it spoken. Theoretically, she could write the language at a rudimentary level if she found some way to produce the complex 3D fractal characters, perhaps using some kind of hologram technology. But this is impossible with a two-dimensional writing method like pen and paper. The PC also won't be able to understand everything she reads. To the PC, it's a completely foreign language with no frame of reference. Knowing the fractal language lowers the difficulties of interacting with the technology of the windmill by one, unless stated otherwise. So, as I said a little earlier, I want to, with this adventure, I want to try to keep it from just feeling like a Dungeons & Dragons dungeon crawl. So, the last thing I want is to bring out a map with squares on it or hexes on it and uncover little bits of it as they explore and move their miniatures around. Like, I don't want that kind of feel or gameplay experience in this. I want it to be more open-ended. I want the GM to feel more free to come up with things on the fly or elaborate things how they want. So I came up with a series of tables that you can either pick things from or you can roll on. And these include things like Numenera devices and things that the PCs find that they can scavenge ciphers and shins and even artifacts from. It includes various creatures that are within the facility. It includes environmental hazards from the facility itself, whether from the security systems or from malfunctions in the technology or places that have been physically damaged and things like that. So I had a lot of fun coming up with all that stuff. And again, you know, everything I come up with for this, I'm not just throwing random things in. I'm thinking about, you know, in D&D, they call it dungeon ecology. You know, why is this, if it's a creature, why is this creature here? How did it get here? Why is it still here? Things like that. I'm not going to go through all of the encounters I came up with. I came up with way more than you will need because I wanted the GM to be able to pick and choose the encounters that she likes. I left this very open-ended as far as how much time it takes the PCs to explore the facility. I believe in our game session, I think it took three sessions from the beginning of the adventure to when they completed the windmill. I think that took three sessions. And I just kind of did it by feel. I kind of, when I felt like it was getting a little old or the players were ready to move on from this place, and I kind of wrapped it up. And I like doing it that way because some of your groups will really want to explore this place and they could spend 10 sessions exploring this one facility and be tickled pink. And then other groups, you know, if they're in the same place for more than a couple sessions, they start to get bored. So I left this very open-ended. You can also expand the facility below ground quite a bit if you want. So it's really up to each GM and each group how much time they want to spend here. So I came up with a lot more encounters than you will probably need. And of course, you can always throw in your own stuff. So basically, the adventure culminates in the PCs finding what I call the satellite control room, assuming it's even a satellite this thing connects to. So far in the adventure, I have been vague about that. Like, I haven't even, in the GM sections, I haven't even said what it is. I've left that open. I will probably define it because my players are very interested in this place that the windmill connects to, and they want to go there, which originally I wasn't even really thinking about having that be part of the adventure. But since they were interested in it, I think it's possible that other groups will be interested in that. So I think it's likely that I will come up with that. And so in that case, that will be defined. But part of what I'm doing with the Obsidian Monolith is there's a few kind of core adventures that unfold the plot as it is. And then there are quite a few optional adventures that either you can do or you cannot do. And a lot of them also you can do at various times and places. So you can kind of sprinkle them in where you want. And so exploring the satellite or whatever it ends up to be could be one of those optional adventures. And again, it, you know, every group's going to be different. Some people are going to want to take this and use it as an entire campaign, which is kind of how I'm envisioning it, where, you know, this is the career of your character is playing through this campaign. And then some groups may want to get through this and go do something else, like the Devil Spine or something. So I'm trying to create it in such a way that you can use it as much or as little as you want. So again, it culminates with them finding this control room where they hopefully are able to figure out the technology enough to figure out what's going on. Now, one encounter that is kind of the BBEG of the adventure is before the PCs reach the control room, they encounter a disassembler, which is a creature from the core book. This is a fairly threatening creature. It's a level 5. And this disassembler is here. We don't know if the disassembler was originally part of the facility or if it has come later and for some reason decided to stay here. But the disassembler is protecting the control room and the PCs must deal with it to get through to the control room. And I assume this would be a combat encounter. However, my group ended up kind of making friends with the disassembler, which was pretty cool, and actually ended up in them finding out a lot more about the facility and what's going on with it than they normally would have been able to, which again is a good reason as a GM to come up with more information than you think you need. I said at the very beginning of the episode how, you know, when I'm telling you what the windmill is and what it does, how there's really no way for the PCs to find this out. Well, they befriended this disassembler, and the disassembler knew some of this information and was able to convey it. So it's always a good idea to have more than what you need, because you may end up needing it, because you never know what your PCs will do. So I have a lot of stuff with the disassembler, which I've of course revised since my playtest, because I've added a lot about what to do if the PCs manage to befriend it. Which, you know, at the time I just did that on the fly because I hadn't anticipated that, although I should have. I really should have. Again, I'm suffering from all those years playing D&D with the, you know, the binary thinking of thinking they're going to be murder hobos all the time. And that's what I love about Numenera is most of the PCs I've run for have not been murder hobos, which is awesome. So I added that. And then I have a whole section on dealing with the control room and repairing it. And you can listen to the actual play to see how that played out. But basically, you know, like anything in a game, it boils down to some role playing and some roles. There are various, the roles are actually really hard. We're looking at difficulty 6 and 7 roles, which for a tier 1, or they might at this point be tier 2 group, is pretty challenging. But I've put various things in the adventure to help them. At one point, they can get access to basically a toolbox that has these hyper advanced tools that were designed for use in the facility, and they can use up to 2 of those as assets for these roles. Learning the fractal language makes the roles easier, and things like that. So at this point, the PCs basically have two options. They can interact with the technology and figure it out and figure out what's going wrong and solve it, which is really the best solution. Or if for some reason they don't want to do that, they can try to destroy the place, which again, the materials of the structure of the windmill itself are all level 10. So there's going to be at least one difficulty 10 task, probably more than one, involved in destroying it. So that will be very difficult, much more difficult than actually figuring things out and doing it that way. Will also lead to a catastrophic explosion. Will also lead to intense radiation flooding the immediate area, which is going to mean mutations for the PCs and everything else around. Will also discharge electricity that hurts the PCs. And also will not solve the problem soon enough for the plants this year, which is going to have all kinds of ramifications. So once the PCs have resolved this one way or another, they head back to town, and assuming that they resolved it in a satisfactory way, once the people in the town learn through Father On what they've done, they're basically heroes of the town. They get lots of cool little benefits at this point. For instance, Madame Sadel puts them up in her inn free of charge for basically as long as they want to stay. They get free meals, free room and board, all that good stuff. Father On sends recommendations on to his contacts that are still in good standing with the Order of Truth in Charmond. At this point, if a PC is not a member and would like to be, Father On can basically give him a field commission, I think would be the term, and they can become a member of the order. And if they are already a member, Father On recommends them for advancement within the order. And in the section on the Order of Truth in the core book, we're told that once you're a member of the order, you can, anytime you would be able to get a skill, you can instead get a tier 1 nano esoteric, even if you're not a nano. So at this point, all of the PCs have the option of being a member of the Order of Truth and can do that if they want. Now, in my group, one of the players, because of his character's backstory, declined becoming a member. So that could happen with you too, and that is going to be interesting. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the first adventure, the basics of it. If there's anything else you'd like to know about the first adventure, I know I gave the broad strokes. Let me know and maybe I can cover it, or check out the actual play, because again, you can hear me run this with my group and all will be revealed in the actual play. I think that pretty much wraps it up for The Windmill in the Woods. Let me know what you think.
Coming up next on The Obsidian Monolith.
So next time on The Obsidian Monolith, I will talk more about the consequences and aftermath of the Windmill of the Woods and what happens when the PCs return to Bonespur, and we'll then go into the next adventure, the next part of the story of The Obsidian Monolith. Well, that's going to wrap up Game Master's Journey. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. Please go find me on Google Plus. You can just search for Lex Starwalker. And please join the Game Master's Journey Google Plus community. You can find a link to it on our website at starwalkerstudios.com in the Game Master's Journey show notes. And please follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Please call the voicemail 626-LEX-GMI-1. And again, please visit our website, starwalkerstudios.com. There you can find the show notes for this show. You can find helpful links, links to our Google Plus community, and you can also find our other podcasts that we put out. So once again, I thank you for joining me on my journey as a Game Master, and I look forward to coming back next week. So until then, game on!
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music,
provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Transboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.